I think I'm entitled.
You want answers.
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
This is Larry Connors USA. Larry Connors USA.
This is, you know, an impartial bank executive who's charged with protecting the bank from money laundering and other nefarious activities. And there you see that he's flagged four or five serious concerns with this $5 million payment from China, much of which went into Hunter Biden's bank account. And as you said, this is in the backdrop of the Chinese Communist Party trying to compromise American politicians via bribing their family members.
That bank examiner, as you were hearing being discussed by Miranda Devine with the New York Post, had noted that back in 2018. During the Obama administration, he was, as a bank examiner, working on behalf of his bank, trying to do his duty, and he wasn't trying to do anything that was trying to be political. He wasn't doing anything other than his job, and that was to protect the bank. And by protecting the bank, they're looking at money that comes in and out of certain accounts, and if it raises enough suspicion, the bank needs to be aware of it, and do we continue business with this client? We have told you previously that there were numerous SARS reports filed that involved Hunter Biden and our other Biden family members. SARS reports are suspicious activity reports a bank must file. It must file if there's anything suspicious about something, like maybe the amount, how often it comes and goes, where it originated, where it goes. The whole idea was to basically track laundering money through mobsters, drug traffic, and so forth. But anytime you're moving money around in a suspicious manner, the bank has to issue the SARS report. Well, this bank investigator raised concerns about payments involving Hunter Biden getting, payments he was getting, in an internal memo to the bank back in 2018. He said the activity on the bank account that Hunter had, his company bank account for a law firm, seemed to be unusual. And now House Oversight Committee Chair James Comer said it was unusual, the amount of money coming and going, and why. Now, again, the investigator was not doing anything on a political basis. He's doing it basically as an accounting investigator. Bank employee, he is the Bank Secrecy Act manager. He alerted colleagues in an email to what he considered unusual activity after a Chinese government-linked company gave $5 million to fund a joint venture between Hunter Biden and a Chinese businessman. James Comer in a news release stated, the bank investigator was so concerned about Hunter Biden's financial transactions that he wanted to reevaluate the bank's relationship with the customer. Look, you've got a big customer. You don't want to tick them off. But if you begin to see signs that are going to jeopardize the bank, it is your job, your duty, your fiduciary to step forward and call it out. Then if the bank board says it's go, we're going to let it go, well, then that's their decision. But you've got yourself protected. They were using Hunter and James Biden, Joe Biden's brother, earned a significant income from their partnership with this Chinese government-linked company beginning shortly after Joe Biden left office in 2017. So the Bank Examiner, and as we've already seen released through the Oversight Committee, you're talking about at least $5 million. The other day they were talking about it could be up to $50 million. This one's dealing with $5 million, and there's another $400,000 on the same day that Hunter gets some money, transfers to another group he has to handle overseas business dealings, and then later money going to James Biden, and James Biden's wife then writes Joe Biden a $40,000 check and apparently wrote on it loan repayment or loan statement, something of that nature. But there's no evidence of any loan. No document supporting it was repayment for a loan. You can loan money to a relative. You don't even have to put down there as to what it is. You just give it to them. But when it's that amount of money and it goes to the bank, it raises a few questions. I know the last time that the holding company for Larry Connors USA wrote me a $25 million check. That's right. That didn't happen, did it? That's why I'm not under investigation so far. But all of this stuff was going on. And if I cannot insist and remind you enough, if Republicans did not control the House, you would never know any of this. None of it. The same thing as if Trump had not beat Hillary, you would have never known that they bought and paid for, through the Democrat National Committee and Hillary's campaign committee, a fabricated report used to get additional spy information, or try to anyway, on Trump and his family. You wouldn't know any of it. Makes you wonder, what else do we not know? Miranda Devine also pointed out the Bank Examiner, in looking at all this, apparently he could see where some money was being spent, and he apparently had enough of a background or knowledge that he checked in on Hunter and he saw a lifestyle that also raised flags.
This bank investigator had been watching Hunter Biden because, he had money problems. There were reports from his divorce that he was spending enormously on drugs and alcohol and prostitution. Then you have the fact that he was a politically exposed person as the son of the vice president, the fact the payments were erratic, and that they were being paid for no discernible service. Supposedly they were a loan, a business loan, but there were no documents and no terms for that supposed loan. That's a story that James Comer has been telling across a whole lot of different bank documents. Loans, they don't appear to be, and that's a classic excuse the IRS always looks for when people are trying to hide the real source of money.
Yeah, it's not very easy to hide when there's documentation. That's why many say, don't put anything down on a text message. Don't put it on an email, even if you think it's encrypted. Do not write a check, cash only. But anytime you have transactions like that going on, I remember several years ago, I did a piece on cocaine trafficking. I went up to see a Chicago DEA agent in a nondescript building, nondescript hallway, simple number on the door. But once they opened it for me, I mean, there were locked down cages all around because they were holding a lot of heroin, coke, and others, contraband. They didn't want anybody to come in and try to steal it. So I'm talking to the guy. He says, you do know, he says, the problem is this one guy might just be giving some dope to a friend. But then he or the friend decide, we can make some money. So then you got to find someone to sell to, and you got to make sure that they're good, and they're not going to be working for law enforcement. And now you probably have somebody in the middle to separate you so you're not directly tied. And the, every time you add another layer, the more exposed you are. Hunter Biden is finding that out. So last night's debate, as they will sometimes to call it, between Florida Governor DeSantis, California Governor Newsom. Did you watch? Did it change anything in your mind? Did it change anything at any point? Well, it did highlight differences between red states and blue states.
There's one thing, in closing, that we have in common is neither of us will be the nominee for our party in 2024.
You have $6 or $7 a gallon gas. How do they afford that? These are folks that are blue-collar people.
You were talking about
tax rates. You're going to force everybody to buy an electric vehicle. How are they going to be able to afford electric vehicles?
I don't like the way you demean people. I don't like the way you demean the LGBTQ community. I don't like the way you demean and humiliate people you disagree with, Ron.
You have the freedom to defecate in public in California. You have the freedom to pitch a tent on Sunset Boulevard. You have the freedom to create a homeless encampment under a freeway and even light it on fire. You have the freedom to have an open-air drug market and use drugs.
And where was that demeaning people or bullying them? I mean, he was simply pointing out the FACTS facts. And, of course, there was Newsom standing up for how you attack the LGBTQ community. Why isn't Newsom screaming out against Hamas and the Sharia law people who would execute LGBTQ people in the streets? Now, going into the debate, there'd been a prediction made by a CNN analyst, Michael Smirkonish.
I predicted that Gavin Newsom and Ron DeSantis would win the debate and that Nikki Haley and Kamala Harris would lose the debate. And I think that's the net effect of it. I think each of them, first of all, I think it's a Rorschach test. Like whoever won, whatever that means, it depends on whether you suit up in your blue or your red armor. But each of them were able to elevate their game and elevate their status as a future within their party. Do I think that it really moved the needle for DeSantis against Nikki Haley? Probably not. But, you know, you can't now talk about the future of the Democratic Party and an heir apparent to Joe Biden without talking about Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris and then everybody else.
And that is a point, obviously, that is going to be of some value to not only for Newsom, but also for DeSantis, since he's actually in the current battle. So then after the debate, as again, I'm using the term only as they referred to it, it really was, they were not debating their particular politics, and yet they were, as they were talking about the differences between how they run their states. And we know the crime that exists, the cost that exists, the taxes that exist and increasing in blue states, much less the illegal immigration, because suddenly a blue state and a blue area like Martha's Vineyard, we can't handle, we got 500 illegals here, and every summer Martha's Vineyard is filled with thousands of people who come to visit Martha's Vineyard. But you get 500 illegals sent up there by DeSantis, and this is inhumane, it's inhumane. So after all of the so-called exchanges back and forth, DeSantis answered questions at a press conference.
We are going to be aggressive at going after these radical district attorneys. Well, we have tools with the Justice Department. They are causing serious carnage to their communities. And you can just talk to people. And like when I'm sitting up there and I said at the beginning, he knows how to spin. He does this. But like to try to put the lipstick on the pig and say somehow crime is not a problem in L.A. Just talk to people. You go visit. I talk to people. They go to a hotel. They're like, I want to walk down the street. And the guy at the front of the desk will say, what are you doing? You're leaving the hotel? Yeah, I'm going to. No. You can't walk down that street. The women take off their jewelry. So that's happening. And that's not right. And I think every American should have the right to live in peace and security. And to elect people who say they have an agenda not to enforce the law, that's unacceptable. If you don't like a law, you run for the legislature and you try to change the law. You don't get elected to an executive position and then nullify the law.
Nullify it in the sense that we're just not going to follow it. And that is what's been happening, of course, with the Soros-funded district attorneys across the nation. Doing away with bail. Or just deciding that's not going to really be a crime anymore. Then they make their own ruling against the law that's in front of them. And since they are deciding factors at that point, the citizens of their area suffer. And those who suffer the most are often the minority community. When on one hand the left is saying all of we're doing here is trying to make things more equitable and better for minority communities, they're actually doing it for minority thugs, and thugs are outside the minority community as well, but certainly it's hurting the minority community. Black lives matter at all levels, wouldn't they? Regardless of your income, wherever you live. White lives matter, red, yellow, green, whatever you want to put in. Every human being has value. Unless you're on the left and you're all about women's rights, unless it's a baby girl about to be born. I want you to hear another analyst for CNN. I think it's important that you hear the other sides. I know that many of you don't even want to think about watching. I do the dirty work for you. But again, I'd have to say that some of her comments are not that disputable. This is Leah Rigger.
I'm not so sure that the country gained a lot. I think in theory, the idea of two governors really duking it out to talk about policy issues and significant ideological differences is something that the American people have been missing for a really long time. I'm not so sure that that's what we had last night. Instead, I think what we saw were two candidates who were really just pitching to their own audiences. I know Newsom said a lot about wanting to speak to Fox News viewers and, you know, introduce himself to new audiences.
Remember, he did that red state tour.
Right, he did the tour. He also has gone on Hannity before.
Yep.
But it's also true that, you know, with somebody who is a communicator like Newsom, it looks like a highlight reel, right? Like, this is perfect for later on as he is, you know, trying out for various positions, trying to raise his national profile. I actually think the person who needed this the most was Ron DeSantis. His campaign is falling apart. It's flailing. It's all over the place. And this was actually a different Ron DeSantis than we've seen before. It wasn't terrific, but it was a lot more energetic than we've seen him and feistier than we've seen him in the past. And for him, that's good enough.
And I think she's right on point. I think it probably raised DeSantis's standing for those who were bothering to watch, or the clips that he will now use in campaign going forward. He still has to worry about Nikki Haley and all the money she's getting. And then there's that guy that's way out in front, lapped you twice already, Donald Trump. Coming up, we want to talk about whiskey being made in Missouri, legally. Stand by, please.
You are listening to Larry Connors, USA.
I want to share something special with you. I've told you how Wellington Environmental works to keep hospitals, schools, businesses safe for their patients, students, clients, employees. Wellington can do the same for you. Perfect example. A relative went to the basement, almost knocked over by the smell. A sewer line had broken. A call to Wellington, a crew was dispatched. First thing, make the home safe. Then clean up the mess. Truly clean it up. Now, I'm telling you this because I want the best for you. Wellington Environmental. Here's the number, 314-644-4930. 644-4930. AAA rating with the Better Business Bureau. 844-4930. Wellington Environmental. Your world. Cleaner, better, safer. Be well with Wellington.
Talk radio made in St. Louis.
Very excited for what you guys are doing for the St. Louis community.
For St. Louis.
Relevant local talk.
Saying what we are thinking.
This is News Talk STL.
No, you guys are awesome. I love you. And it really, it's a tremendous honor to be on the station.
News, analysis, and opinion.
Thanks for covering the local angle.
Come on, people. This is America.
We better open our eyes.
Really local? Really good.
News Talk STL at 101.9/94.1
and NewsTalkSTL.com.
As a truck driver, I've learned how important road safety is. I know that large trucks need more time and room to stop. That's why I always hang back and follow other vehicles at a safe distance. Everyone can help keep our roads safe. Next time you're driving, try to remember to always give trucks extra space when you merge in front of them. Let's all plan to share the road safely. Learn how at www.sharetheroadsafely.gov.
This is Christina Strait with Strait Realty reminding you why pay more than four. In 2003, we had a dream to start a real estate company that would revolutionize the real estate market. Now, 20 years later, after navigating through the many markets' ups and downs, we know exactly how to help you in this challenging time. I'm Christina Strait, owner of Strait Realty. Don't give away your hard-earned equity. Give us a call today, 314-441-4444, 314-441-ALL-4s. And remember, why pay more than four?
Strait Realty is a licensed broker in the state of Missouri.
I have a great whiskey suggestion. Stolach Whiskey, created using natural limestone filtered water from the Ozark Highlands, aged in Missouri oak. Next time, get a bottle. But if you're going to share with friends, you better get at least two bottles. Stolach has the Larry Connors seal of approval. See the full story at Stolach.com. Stolach, Stolloch, from Stone Ledge Distillery.
Must be the whiskey. I've been drinking to remember and drinking to forget. I got I love you on my mind. I got Jim Beam on my breath and loneliness has got the rest. I've got nothing left within me. It must be the whiskey.
This is Larry Connors USA.
Larry Connors USA.
Oh, I got to tell you, the genius of my co-producer, Quentin, must be the whiskey. That explains a lot of things, good and bad. Oh, so I never try to hide anything from you, the audience. I'm always fully transparent. My next guest and his company do sponsor Larry Connors USA, and for that I'm thankful. But this next segment, and we're not trying to sell you, I just want to give you information because it's a very fascinating story at many levels. The guest and the CEO is president also of Stone Ledge Distillery, Mark Sutherland. Mark, welcome aboard.
Well, good to hear your voice, Larry, as always.
Well, and listening to you is, I hear a Southern Texas accent. Is that what I hear?
Right, yes. From the heart of Missouri's Ozark Highlands.
Yeah.
I actually come from a different highlands, but I'm now transplanted into Missouri's Ozark Highlands, which is a thrill to be here. It's a beautiful part of America, and I've been here for a number of years.
Yeah,
I'm thrilled to be a part of what's going on here.
And first time I met you, I liked you and that accent. And now you don't wear a kilt or anything, do you? I'm just getting personal.
Oh, I do wear a kilt when I have the opportunity.
Okay.
yeah, so that's definitely a part of my heritage.
Well, let me ask you, you were at the coronation of the king. I saw the picture. Are you some kind of ambassador for the nation or St. Louis or what?
So I have the privilege of serving in two capacities. One is His Majesty's Honorary Consul to the state of Missouri, where I represent the British government interests across the state. And then secondly, as a global Scot, where I'm a pseudo unofficial ambassador for Scotland when it comes to businesses around the world. So it's an honor to serve both the country I was born in, the country I grew up in, and the country that adopted me.
Well, glad to have you, obviously. Certainly with what you decided to create. And in Scotland, you've got a lot of great whiskeys. Let's begin with Stone Ledge itself. This is a Missouri-based still, correct?
Yeah, so we're a Missouri company. Proudly, everything about our company is Missouri, from the very water we use in our spirits, of the entire production and all the crops and grains are all from Missouri. I've been in Missouri since 1989, and as I've been here over the years, I have discovered more and more of the state and fallen more and more in love with what Missouri has to offer. And one of the things I discovered a few years back was that Missouri has a long 200-plus-year history of distilling spirits. Some of it really good, some of it more of the moonshine variety.
Yeah.
But there's that history, and I dug into why. One is this massive limestone shelf that's called the Ozark Highlands. It's also been called the Ozarks and the Ozark Mountains. But it's the Ozark Highlands that stretches from basically I-70 in Missouri all the way south, halfway down Arkansas. And it's a massive limestone shelf that gives us all natural limestone filtered water, mineral water, which is one of the best base ingredients to make a really good spirit with. Combine that with most of the barrels in the world that are called American oak are actually Missouri oak and are either grown and made here or just grown here and made somewhere else. So you've got those core natural ingredients that are essential to whiskey globally, and Missouri is at the center of that. So discovering that and then also being an avid consumer of whiskey and other spirits, we decided to launch our little venture and be part of writing the next chapter in that 200-plus-year history of the Ozark Highlands.
Well, I will tell you this. You had me when you said, here's whiskey. You got me right there. but again, folks, I'm being very transparent. Mark and I are friends, and also they are a sponsor. And if I were going to add any comment that you could take to the bank, and that is, I like it. It's very smooth. And do you think that is part of the process, that it's limestone filtered, the Stoloc whiskey?
So the water is a base ingredient. There's certain parts of our process that we have that make it a little bit more unique. So we do extra long fermentation. And what that means is normal fermentation within the industry is anywhere from 3 to 7 days for any kind of spirit. We do a minimum of 48 days closed container fermentation. And that takes a lot of the burnout. So, for example, with our vodka, it takes the ethanol smell out. It takes almost all the burnout for most people. On the whiskey, it just smooths things out. So it then allows it to just be, there's no pain in the throat. There's no rawness in the throat. You still get the spice. You still get the heat, but you don't get the discomfort that sometimes is associated with some whiskey.
Yeah, that does bother some people, and I don't notice that. Now, and again, on the vodka, you've gotten several awards for that. I mean, this is a distilled 8 different times. Process of like that, what decides it we're going to distill 8 times versus 6, or we need to go 2 more?
Well, I mean, eventually we probably will. We'll probably do an ultra premium that's 18 times, for example. But 8 times is a good process. So what people experience with the vodka is the long fermentation takes that smell out, takes that burnout, and then it gives that smoothness to it. And then the distillation process gives it a cleanness. So it's clean and smooth. And then our base ingredient on the vodka, for example, is 100% heirloom seed, Missouri-grown sweet corn. So you get a little bit of sweet there, and you also get a little bit of that mineral from the mineral water we start with and also finish with when we proof down the final product. So it's got all these different interactions with our base ingredients, which are all natural, fully sustainable, and all Missouri.
Well, I do know that back in my younger days, I think I knew some folks that if we went out around their farmland, we had to be really careful because of revenuers, because they were doing moonshine. The state of Missouri has often had, as you said, a history, as have many states. Especially during Prohibition Day, bringing whiskey and various spirits, moonshine, tough, light, whatever you wanted to call it at the time. But this growth of whiskey in Missouri, are there others looking at this? I mean, if you've got that limestone ledge, others have got to be considering how they can make use of it.
Yeah, so in Missouri, back in 2000, we had, I believe, only 7 distilleries in the state of Missouri. Today, we have more than 50. One of the fastest growing states when it comes to distillery growth. And you've got everything from your larger ones like Nobleton's or Rieger's over in Kansas City or some of the other distilleries. And then you've got some smaller mom-and-pop farm-based type distilleries as well, varying styles and qualities. So there is that robust history, but it's that, that water is a huge part of it, in my opinion.
And what kind of what kind of regulations are in place to make sure that it's going to be not just maybe good to the taste, but not be harmful to people, except in over indulgence.
Yes, exactly. So I mean, it's a federally regulated and state regulated industry, so you can always be assured of any distillery that's putting out product into the marketplace has quality controls in place. And then it's up to the individual distillery as far as what their process is and how that impacts the final product. So, you know, we are fully sustainable, all Missouri. Others are buying buying the alcohol from other states and bringing it in and blending it. Barrel King down in Bourbon is a phenomenal blender, very, very talented. All his juice is coming from somewhere else, but he finishes it in Missouri and does a phenomenal job with it. So really dig in and find out the history behind your favorite distilled spirit, and then go out and try some of the other 50-plus distilleries around the state and see what new discoveries you can make.
And how much is being exported from Missouri to other states elsewhere?
There's a significant amount across the country. I mean, for example, we're about to launch into the United Kingdom next year, so we're going international with our products.
Okay.
A lot of distilleries are in, you know, 4, 5, 6 states around the region and picking up others because we do some really good quality spirits in Missouri.
What made you decide you wanted to get into this? I mean, did you sit down sometime like maybe in the third grade and decide I want to make whiskey?
It was a very scientific, deep thought process that included sitting around with the right people and drinking some whiskey.
Uh-huh.
And coming up with an idea that still sounded good the next morning. That's pretty much where it started.
I would tell you that I made some. This would not happen nowadays. But in my high school chemistry class, I was failing. But there was one thing that we were doing. They were actually fermenting moonshine. And on the period of days we were going through it, then we all were allowed to take, you know, a little small shot glass, a bit of it, and some didn't want to drink any, and I got extra. But I thought, I think I could like this kind of work, but I couldn't make a living at it. When I see companies of any type that are going and creating and invigorating an industry that's already there, I applaud you.
No, it's definitely a group process. We've got a lot of investors, a lot of owners. Our contracted distiller who actually owns another distillery that's producing our spirits for us is phenomenally talented, has an incredible reputation. His name is Demetrius Kane, if you've ever met him. He's got the ZZ Top style beard and fantastic artist when it comes to whiskey. And we're thrilled that he's been contracting with us to produce Stolach and Inversion Vodka. But it's a group thing. And really the best thing about this is all the people who have fallen in love with what we're producing and are advocating for us and telling their friends and buying their gifts. That's the best. That's the best part
sure,
of that
sure.
one.
Well,
you see that community being built around it.
And the other thing is you're protecting and making it clear to everyone it has Missouri ties by your logo.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it is. You know, for our distillery logo, we have the Missouri mule, but it's a kicking mule. It's one with attitude. It's one that's getting things done and changing something.
Right.
So we're thrilled to be really representing Missouri as we spread our whiskey and our vodka around the world.
Well, I appreciate your time, and certainly we appreciate your support. But now I think folks also have a better understanding of what's happening in this business, which I did not know until you and I sat down one day and really got a good handle on it. I thank you, Mark, for your time, and I would work on that accent a little bit better.
It's all I got.
Mark Sutherland, CEO of Stone Ledge Distillery. Very interesting story. I always thought it was. And if I were going to add a commercial statement, I'd say, yes, very fine drink. Coming up, the latest on Hamas and that Chinese balloon. Stand by, please.
You can connect with Larry on Twitter at Larry Connors USA.
I'm always glad to have new sponsors, but I have turned some down. See, I only endorse clients if I believe in them. And I've been a spokesman for John Beal for 10 years. Through those years, listeners said they went with John Beal because they trusted me. And just recently, a woman named Mary wrote, "We got a John Beal roof based on your recommendation." Thank you, Mary, and all the others for calling John Beal, 1-800-NEW-ROOF, 1-800-NEW-ROOF.
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811, brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
Ackerman Toyota has the 2024 models. You're going to be impressed. Check them out in person at Ackerman Toyota, Hampton and Interstate 44. In fact, you've got to see the 2024 Toyota Sequoia. Very impressive. This is the time to buy and get top dollar for your vehicle. Looking for pre-owned? Ackerman Toyota can also help you. Ackerman Toyota at Hampton and 44. AckermanToyota.com. Ackerman Toyota for life.
The United States Deputy Sheriff's Association is a national nonprofit and the largest non-governmental provider of services to law enforcement. The USDSA assists city, county, state, and federal agencies with free safety equipment donations and officer survival training, along with cash donations to families of law enforcement officers who perished in the line of duty, a citizen awareness program, and more. For more information on United States Deputy Sheriff's Association, please visit usdeputy.org.
Lit Cigar Lounge in Chesterfield is so luxurious you might think you have to be a member. You don't, but you will quickly see why Lit won the 2023 Riverfront Times Best Smoking Lounge, Best Smoke Shop for the second time in a row. Quality cigars, premium drinks. So join me at Lit, just off 40 in the district at Chesterfield. For special events, entertainment, always check the website, litstl.com. litstl.com.
This is Larry Connors, USA.
All right, so I've been looking at this story throughout the day, and I know that some of you have heard it to some extent, and I've been looking for additional sources and material that would go with it and back it up, so I don't have them. I'm going to have to go with the source as reported, being the New York Times. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying it's correct. I'm just saying it is one of these slap-in-the-face stories that you're going to have to really raise some big questions, and leadership of Israel could be in great jeopardy. Let me get right to it. The New York Times reported, Israeli officials obtained the Hamas battle plans for the October 7 terrorist attack more than a year before it happened, according to documents, emails, and interviews carried out by the New York Times. Israeli military and intel officials at the time dismissed the plan as aspirational, considering it too difficult for Hamas to carry out. They dubbed it, either they did or Hamas did, the Jericho Wall. I assume Israel did. But the document did circulate widely among the Israeli military and intel leaders. But again, the experts at that time said, no way they can carry out something like that. The scale and ambition is beyond the ability and capability of Hamas. So they conceded. Now, privately, had these warnings been taken seriously and they had redirected significant reinforcements to the south where Hamas attacked, Israel could have blunted the attacks, perhaps even prevented them. Israel's military and intel chiefs have taken responsibility for the failure to stop the attack. And Prime Minister Netanyahu has acknowledged he will face a reckoning. But right now, everything is being put on lockdown as far as questioning and redirecting focus and blame until after the war, until after Hamas is destroyed. But there will be a reckoning, especially based upon the New York Times. They had evidence of it almost a year before it happened. They just didn't think they could do it. I'm going to ask something here, and I want you to consider the thought. If word had come out, and there was an early warning reference to Pearl Harbor, but it was dismissed and kind of put aside, but if word had come out that the Japanese Imperial Navy was going to bring its fleet into the Hawaiian waters and eventually launch planes to carry out Pearl Harbor, how much would have been believed at that time? I raise that question because it might be a parallel to what we're discussing here. Now, here's another development involving Israel and Hamas. This is going to have some blowback quickly. It won't be something that's going to be waiting until after the war is basically over. Earlier this week, the White House National Security Spokesman, John Kirby, stated, "We do not support southern operations," you're talking about the southern part of Gaza, right up against Egypt, "unless or until the Israelis can show that they've accounted for all the internally displaced people of Gaza." That's impossible. That's impossible to account for all those who have been displaced. We're talking about 2.5 million just around the Gaza City area. And finding them, locating them, even if they're buried under rubble, much less if they were basically evaporated by some explosion. He said Israel has the, quote, right and responsibility to eliminate Hamas, but didn't explain how these priorities could be reconciled. That was earlier this week, National Security Spokesman John Kirby. If you remember in the beginning, before any of the Israeli bombs began to hit into Gaza, they gave days of warning to Palestinians living in that region. Go south. Get out of the northern portion. You'll be safer. Some did. Some maybe wanted to go. Maybe were shot in the back by Hamas terrorists that didn't want them to leave because they wanted to use them as human shields, which they certainly have. But now if all of them are gathered, they're not all, but those who are gathered at the southern end of Gaza, if you're going to go in and get Hamas, how are you going to get to them again without getting civilian casualties? And don't forget, you're with the border of Egypt at that point. And you've got possibility that Egypt could be unintentionally drawn into this. But here are the statements that got leaked to the Israeli press, the Times of Israel, quoting a transcript of his meeting with the Israeli War Cabinet. Blinken is being quoted as saying, "You cannot operate in southern Gaza in the way you did in the north. There are 2 million Palestinians there. You need to evacuate fewer people from their homes, be more accurate in the attacks, not hit UN facilities, and ensure that there are enough protected areas for civilians, and if not, then not to attack where there is a civilian population. What is your system of operation?" Well, he just laid out exactly what every coach tells the team before they go on the field. We do our basics, defense, block, tackle, we will win the game. That's what we're going to do. Of course, in this case, we're talking about a deadly result. But everything he laid out, they know exactly what he just told them. They don't need to be told that. Then his question, what is your system of operation? I just told you the dire consequences that could be faced. What are you doing about it? The IDF chief responded, saying, "We follow a number of principles, proportionality, distinction, the laws of war. There were instances where we attacked on the basis of those principles, and instances where we decided not to attack because we waited for a better opportunity." Then the defense minister chimed in this meeting, saying the entire Israeli society is united behind the goal of dismantling Hamas, even if it takes months. At that point, Blinken said something that is a flashpoint. His response, "I don't think you have the credit for that." What does that mean exactly? He didn't explain. Credit being in the sense of financial credit from the U.S., political credibility on the world stage. The administration, we know, Biden and the weaklings in that White House are facing pressure from their own staff, left-wing voters, to shift away from Israel. Many of the young who might be voting in this next election have already said they're not going to vote for Biden because he's siding with Israel. They do not know anything about the PLO, Hamas, and what's been going on. They really don't. Or they would realize that if they're out there shouting LGBTQ loves Hamas, their heads would be chopped off immediately. I had an extended piece in the first hour, if you missed it, dealing with 20 plus years ago, the efforts to create a two-state solution. If you missed that hour, may I encourage you to make sure you pull that up. Either watch it or listen to it. You go to LarryConnorsUSA.com, LarryConnorsUSA.com. It's a history lesson that should be taught, especially those in the streets yelling, "Yay for Hamas! Yay for Palestine!" not even knowing facts. Speaking of facts, I tried to book him today, but he's on the road traveling a lot. A writer for the Washington Examiner had a piece dealing with a Chinese defense research report that states basically, this is a group of researchers at a National University of Defense Technology, and apparently this was dealing with what to do about another Chinese high-altitude balloon. According to this new command, they're prepared to conduct merciless attacks in a conflict with the U.S. That's what the Chinese are planning. The report is titled Near Space Operations Command. Not from afar, way out in space, but closer, much closer, as in that balloon that transcrossed our nation. The report, the Near Space Operations Command, has been made public during a Beijing conference on command and control. And they say the new operations command will direct hypersonic missiles against heavily protected targets, including communications equipment and hubs in the heartland of an adversary, probably close to where you're sitting right now. That is some of the information they got out of that one balloon going across and us doing nothing about it. By the way, China is also developing efforts to build more aircraft carriers. It's got two conventionally powered now. They're building a much larger one. It's going to be named after Premier Xi because he's the premier. Russia is trying to update its carrier. It has only one carrier. Russian Navy has one air carrier. One. And most of the time it's been in dock for repairs. All right, I want to turn the page and a passing that we need to make note of. Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman named to the U.S. Supreme Court, confirmed, appointed by Ronald Reagan. She died at the age of 93 at her home in Phoenix. The Supreme Court announced her death in a statement saying the cause involved complications of dementia. In a public letter she'd released in 2018, at that time being 88, she hadn't been seen in public for some time, but she did announce that she had been diagnosed with the beginning stages of dementia, probably Alzheimer's, and was going to start withdrawing from public life. William Rehnquist, her Stanford Law School classmate, was Chief Justice during much of her tenure. The Supreme Court during that period was often called the O'Connor Court. She was referred to accurately as the most powerful woman in America. Very little could be done without her signing off on it in the court. This is a piece written for the Associated Press by Linda Greenhouse, and I think it's right on point. When Reagan named her to the Supreme Court in 1981 to fulfill his campaign promise that I will appoint the first female justice, she was on a mid-level appeals court in Arizona. Active in Republican politics, had been friends, or had friends in both parties, 51 years old at the time. The court moved to the right during the period that she was on the court, and her moderate conservatism ended up making her look, in the end, like possibly a liberal. That was not her image overall, but some of the decisions, folks were thinking she must be going and drinking the Kool-Aid. One of the cases that has to be considered immediately would be her actions when it came to Roe v. Wade. She watched with intense interest as the court had that coming before it. Her first vote on abortion came in a 1983 case, Akron versus Akron Center for Reproductive Health. And she then took notice of the court's conclusion in Roe that the government's ability to regulate circumstances under which a woman could terminate a pregnancy depended on the stage of pregnancy. She was already thinking that. And she later wrote, all of this is on a collision course with the point of viability being moved farther back toward conception. She recognized that that was going to happen as we got more and more medically advanced. And she said in the foreseeable future, there would be a threshold of fetal lung development that would prevent the survival of babies before the beginning of the third trimester. She never again mentioned the collision course. When she got pressed in the Webster case for a fifth vote that would overturn Roe v. Wade, she held back. She said the case did not call for overturning Roe. She said if such a case did arrive, there will be time enough to reexamine Roe and do so carefully. 3 years later, Planned Parenthood v. Casey appeared to be that case. Justice O'Connor, two other Republican-appointed justices, Kennedy, Souter, defied expectations. They issued an unusually jointly written opinion that reaffirmed the core of the 1973 Roe v. Wade. And now that's history. One of my prayers every night is for those women who decide not to have an abortion. May they be blessed for not doing that, their child blessed, child blessing them, and the child also blessing society. Who knows what future leaders might come. Remember our pledge, one nation under God.